Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Oregon became the first state to legalize physician-assisted suicide 2 decades ago. Since then, 4 more states in the District of Columbia have followed suit with laws, and in Montana, the practice is court-mandated. Ohio joined the fray last week when State Senator Charlita Tavares announced she will introduce a bill legalizing physician-assisted suicide in the Buckeye State. Coming up, we'll hear from proponents and opponents of the measure. Joining us now by phone is public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Randy Ludlow. Welcome back, Randy.
Good morning, Ann.
What are the odds that this measure will even get a hearing in the Ohio Senate?
Well, it may receive a hearing and sponsor testimony, but given the fact that Senator Tavares hails from the Democrats, who are at a decided disadvantage and distinct minority in the General Assembly, and given the pro-life bent of majority Republicans, I don't know that this really has much of a shot.
But a lot of times when a bill is in that kind of a fix or a proposed bill, you don't write about it. You don't write about every law in the Ohio General Assembly. So this still is significant, is it not?
Well, it's a major issue that Ohio lawmakers have shied away from addressing in recent years. Tavares is working with an advocate for physician-assisted suicide to bring this legislation to the forefront. Even in the states where it is allowed, it's still relatively rare. If you look in Oregon, in 2016, 204 people obtained fatal doses with the assistance of a physician, but only 133 used them to end their lives. The Ohio law would allow a terminally ill person to seek a mixture of drugs to self-administer in their life if they're diagnosed as being terminally ill and within 6 months of death.
We know that, as you described, the Ohio General Assembly is unlikely to, A, take this up with any seriousness, and B, even if it did, that it would pass in this Republican pro-life controlled legislature is unlikely. That said, do we know what Ohioans think about this?
I cannot really say that I've seen this topic polled in any recent polls, Ann.
Have there been other bills introduced over the years to this end?
I do not. I'm not saying there's never been one, mm-hmm. but I certainly do not recall one in recent years.
The Ohio Right to Life was quick to attack the measure. We asked them to join the show. They declined. What are their objections?
Well, I spoke with Michael Ganadakis, who is president of Ohio Right to Life, and this also has a bearing well, is also a member of the State Medical Board of Ohio. And he said death with dignity, as this act is called, is just a mirage, that it's still suicide, it's still murder, although there's an attempt to make it appear compassionate. He said, quote, suicide is always as morally objectionable as murder. Of course, advances in pain management make it possible to control pain appropriately in dying patients. I am sure her legislation will go nowhere in our pro-life legislature.
Why do you think Charlita Tavares introduced this announced plans to introduce this legislation now?
Well, the bill was indeed introduced last week, as
okay.
she said it would be. I think Lisa Vigil Schattinger, who is a nurse by training, now directs the nonprofit Ohio End of Life Options, found a sympathetic ear in Tavares and helped work with her to draft this proposed legislation.
And we will be talking with Lisa Vigil Schattinger. She's co-founder and executive director of the nonprofit Ohio End of Life Options. If you have a question or comment, listeners, we'd like to hear from you about this issue. Like my guest Randy Ludlow of the Columbus Dispatch said, there hasn't been any recent polling on it that we know of. What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Charlita Tavares described a bill that would require multiple steps to ensure that the terminal patient is making an informed decision. Can you give us a thumbnail of what this bill would actually do?
Well, first of all, as noted, you would have to be diagnosed within 6 months of dying. There would have to be informed consent. You would have to acknowledge more than once that this is what you wanted. If there was any question about your mental competency, that would require an evaluation before you could proceed with the process. No physician could be forced to assist you. You would have to find one willing to help you with your end-of-life wishes. And there's a waiting period here, as noted, and you have to self-administer the fatal dose of medication yourself. Now, another potential roadblock here, at least ethically for physicians, is that the American Medical Association opposes physician-assisted suicide, including providing end-of-life medications. Its ethics code states, physician-assisted suicide is fundamentally incompatible with a physician's role as healer, would be difficult or impossible to control, and would pose serious societal risks.
And yet, there's a handful of states that do this now, and patients apparently do find physicians who are willing to participate. Is there any polling of physicians? Is there any sense out there about how they feel about this?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, I would certainly expect the vast majority of physicians would not go along with a plan like this. Mm-hmm. But all you need is a handful, really, given how rare comparatively cases of physician-assisted suicide are.
Is this lawmakers, as I mentioned earlier, in six other states are considering similar legislation. Do you know if this is part of a coordinated effort?
I really have no knowledge on that particular front, Ann.
How much are you going to follow this, Randy Ledlow?
Well, obviously, we'll check and see if it advances anywhere in the legislature. But given the current political climate and overwhelming Republican control, it may not eventually result in more than just a bill introduction. But as we've seen many times at the legislature, sometimes it can take several years, several sessions of trotting out the same legislation and hoping to change the lawmakers' minds and gain public support to lead to eventual passage of a bill.
But the legislature, the makeup of this legislature, that could be a long, long time. Did Charlita Tavares say whether or not they're interested in any kind of referendum on the statewide ballot?
No, she did not bring that up.
Satima in Columbus, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us what you think.
So I just had a comment. I mean, I work in the healthcare field, and I see a lot of patients who are terminally ill, and I would support the option of that being available for them. For example, if a patient is battling with cancer and they're at the end of life and so there's nothing else to do, and they're sick and tired of, you know, the medication, the chemotherapy, and they're exhausted, I think that would be a vital option for them they could have. Although, you know, personally, for me, I would never do that, or I don't even believe in it. But I feel like as a healthcare professional, that option for your patient would be very vital, and it would promote better, you know, better patient care.
Have patients ever talked to you about this and that they would like to see it, they would like the option?
I know a lot of patients who have read about it and who've seen it in different states, who asked about if the state had it or like the progress of the state having that as an option. They do a lot of times often talk about it. It would have been a better option for them instead of suicide, which how we get today. But euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide is very different. It's in a controlled setting, and it would be a better option, in my opinion, if the patients had that as an option, because ultimately it's their choice how to end their life.
The Ohio Right to Life has said that there are better drugs out there to kill pain now to provide comfort for people with terminal conditions that are painful. Doesn't that help?
to a certain extent, I believe that helps, that, you know, medicine is still growing, healthcare is still growing, and then the human body is just amazing and very interesting, and there's still so much we have to learn. And ultimately, when people are sick, they're the only ones who can determine how bad it is. And a lot of times, most of the time, medication helps to a certain extent, and it may not always work for every person.
Satima, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. So Randy Ludlow, she had a press conference. She unveiled this. Did you get any sense from leadership when or if they'll consider it? You said they'll probably get one hearing, but any sense about when that might be?
Well, it's generally just common courtesy to give the sponsor of a bill a first hearing to allow them to address it. But insofar as it gets scheduled for any hearings after that, committee chairs and House leadership would have to be in agreement. And I don't know if this bill is one that would be destined for that.
The agreement that they actually want it to move forward.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, Randy Ludlow, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ann.
Randy Ludlow is public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, we'll hear from two different points of view about this issue. We'd like to hear from our listeners. There hasn't been a lot of public polling done on this, at least not recently. Tell us what you think about a physician-assisted suicide. Would Ohio be a candidate to join the six states out there that already legalized it? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about physician-assisted suicide. State Senator Charlita Tavares of Columbus last week announced plans to introduce a bill that would legalize the process in Ohio. Coming up, we're going to hear from opponents of physician-assisted suicide. We'd also like to hear from listeners. Tell us what you think. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joining us now by phone is Director of Ohio End of Life Options. That's a nonprofit that advocates for death with dignity laws. Lisa Vigil Schattinger is with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is personal for you. Your stepfather moved to Oregon after he was diagnosed with bone marrow cancer in 2014. Tell us what happened.
He actually was a longtime resident of Oregon. He and my mother married in 99, and so he lived there for a while.
Okay.
You know, I have to start out by framing this with the fact that for me personally, I grew up in Oregon. And so this conversation has been a part of my and my family's lives for a very long time. I was there in the debate when they were debating the law in the early 90s. I was in my early 20s and had experience with family members who had died, or friends of family who had died, and people who had been diagnosed with breast cancer. So all of this was a pretty real conversation for me at that time in my life. And so in 2014, when my stepfather, who was a retired neurologist, was diagnosed with a bone marrow cancer, I honestly was not surprised that he chose this option. He was very open and honest with us about his diagnosis and his thoughts about living as well as he could until it was his time to die.
How did he decide when that time had arrived?
That's an interesting question, because people who've used this, their loved ones have reported that they just knew. Jack was in really frail health overall. He had several other things that had been going on with him. And he started to face complications from his disease process, and he knew, you know, what that looked like going down the line. So he had had some pain episodes. He had had some infections come along, and he just knew that he was going to be facing a period of frailty and uncertainty that he just felt he didn't want to face, and he wanted to, in fact, control his death.
We just heard from Randy Ludlow of the Columbus Dispatch, and he made the assertion, and it's, you know, logical that a lot of doctors actually don't support this. The American Medical Association has come out against it. But you said you had lots of conversations. This was a part of the conversation process in your home when you were growing up. How did your stepfather, was he supportive of it before he became a candidate for it?
Yeah, I think he was supportive of it. Again, you never know until you face that moment.
Right.
But I do have to point out that a 2016 Medscape survey of physicians, of over 7,500 physicians, showed that 57% of those that reported do support this option. And the Oregon Medical Society, I'm not exactly sure what their name is, but has had a neutral policy for a long time, and they actually went so far as to recommend in the last couple of years that the AMA revisit their policy because of Oregon's experience with this. And I just thought that was an interesting thing. And we're seeing a lot of state medical boards taking a neutral position. Most recently, Massachusetts took a neutral position after polling its members. So, you know, getting that feedback from their doctors on how to proceed.
Mona Lisa in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, my opinion is I support if the law can be passed, because in my personal opinion, if I am in that kind of condition where it is, there's no way for me to continue, but just hanging to life with just a drip of medicine, and then there is no quality of life for me, I'm just causing everybody else around me, my friends and family, just more, you know, like in despair situations. I do not want that.
Well, you know, go ahead, Mona Lisa.
I want my family to move on, to continue. And even though it will be against what I believe, my religion as a Buddhist, mm-hmm. that we value life over death. But then again, I, you know, in my rational mind, the living must continue. And I prefer, if I in that situation, just to, you know, just to finish it.
Well, it's interesting that Mona Lisa put it that way. And Mona Lisa, by the way, thank you so much for your call. She framed it in terms of the people around her and you know, shielding them from the stress and struggle of watching her die. That is something that people who oppose physician-assisted suicide are worried about, that this will become more about the living and not about the people who have the terminal illness and are facing death.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that thank you to her for sharing her thoughts. Mm-hmm. And we are huge supporters of hospice care. So 90% of the people who've used this law in Oregon are enrolled in hospice. And hospice is, you know, just fantastic at supporting the person and their family, you know, through that process. So we find that people arrive at that decision that it's an option that they want because they want control. They do think of their family, but they just feel that it is, they want to control the time, you know, the place and with whom they are surrounded with when they die, and leave them with that image of a peaceful death. And a study showed actually that family members of people who use this option are actually more prepared for their death and you know, can move on in peace a little bit more easily than people who are surprised or who've experienced someone with a bad death, unfortunately.
For your stepfather, is the Oregon law written so that he could just prescribe himself the drugs, or he have to go to a okay?
Yeah, this is in no way a spontaneous process. The safeguards involved take at least 3 weeks. You have to request once from a physician. So imagine that, sitting down with your physician and saying, you know, doctor, thank you for all the treatment we've had, you know, we've been through, and now I'm facing the terminal portion of my disease. I would like to request this option. That you then have to wait 15 days before requesting it again, and then you have to make a third written request that's witnessed by two people, one of whom has to be in no way related or able to benefit, and then wait, even after writing, you know, the request, you have to wait an additional 48 hours to receive that prescription from a pharmacy. Of course, anyone, the physician or the person can, or the pharmacist can opt out at any time during that process. So no, he could never prescribe for himself. It involves two physicians to evaluate, make sure that you're capable of making decisions and able to take the medication on your own.
We're talking about physician-assisted suicide. A bill has been introduced in the Ohio Senate that would legalize physician-assisted suicide in Ohio. It's not likely to get more than a hearing or so. It is opposed by much of the Republican-controlled General Assembly. If you have a thought about this, though, we'd like to hear from you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest right now is Lisa Vigil Schattinger. She's executive director and co-founder of Ohio End of Life Options. It's an advocacy organization for physician-assisted suicide. Lisa, critics call it procedure-assisted suicide or physician-assisted suicide. I call it that. I'm not a critic. It's just kind of a familiar phrase. But you call it aid in dying. What are the semantics here?
Oh, I think they're pretty important. Just recently, a national suicide prevention organization came out with a statement saying they are different. Suicide and aid in dying are different. As someone myself who lost my own father as a toddler to suicide, I think that saying physician-assisted suicide doesn't bring proper respect to either people who face mental health challenges and feel that suicide is a way out. We want to prevent suicide, absolutely. Those people really need compassion and care and treatment. Versus this concept where a person has unfortunately reached the terminal phase of their disease, their treatment options have run out, and they want to have control over their imminent death. So to me, in our own experience, there is just no comparison between these situations, and I think we need to get better about addressing each of those different types of situations.
Phil in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thanks so much. Mm-hmm. I have a family history of Alzheimer's disease. I lost my grandmother on my dad's side, and then my mother was diagnosed 20 years before she died, 2 years ago, of Alzheimer's. And she had clear directives about end-of-life things that she didn't or didn't want to have happen, but dementia never came up in those. You can't find that in that kind of thing. And for myself, I would like to find language that does that, but there's this catch-22 about having to be mentally competent at the very end, and that's doesn't happen. The way I want to frame this is, it's ironic to me that we can have soldiers willing to throw themselves on a grenade to save the lives of other people and be honored as heroes, and my mother would have done that the last 5 years of her life. She was causing lots of emotional anxiety for my father and the rest of the family, and there was financial drains. And I want to be able to say, I'd like not to do that and draw clear lines. And I wonder if the organization that your guest has is having any conversations about dementia and how you work that into the conversation.
Phil, thanks for your call. Lisa Vigil-Schattinger?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I'm so sorry for your experiences. It is so difficult. This law does not address writing this into an advanced directive. We do need people to be capable of making these decisions and taking it on their own. Now in America, we don't have... I think ways are being developed to try and write these into advanced directives on what care people want if they are faced with that situation. But this law does not address that just because the safeguards really want people to be capable of making those decisions and able to take that on their own. But, you know, on the other hand, I do think that it's important to start talking about all of these scenarios at the end of life and really get people thinking about what their wishes would be in different scenarios.
Phil, thank you so much for your call. Frank in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Frank.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So I'm an ICU physician. I see a lot of people at the end of life. And I feel like, you know, you'd get into the situation a lot less often if, as soon as you were diagnosed with a chronic progressive condition, Alzheimer's, heart failure, COPD, any kind of cancer, if you met with a palliative care doc early in the process, I think, you know, defining what you want the process to look like, what you want the end to look like early on when you're not under duress, I think you come to better conclusions, you make better decisions. And I think if you had that, you would run into the situation where physician-assisted suicide would come up a lot less often.
Why would that be?
Because you'd already have a plan. You'd already have it planned out. The problem is, you know, I see a lot of people who let's say they have a terminal cancer. Nobody's really told them that that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get sepsis. They get a bad infection, and they're under the impression that their cancer is still beatable. And that they should go full bore ICU for the next 3 weeks trying to beat this infection when, in reality, they're going to get to the end of that. They're going to be 2 weeks to keep getting chemo.
Mm-hmm.
If they just thought about that up front, you'd just say, look, it's not worth going through a long, painful ICU admission or, you know, a lot of other sort of invasive measures. You would just say, look, we've gotten to the point where we're not benefiting me anymore. We're doing things to me instead of for me. And you've already kind of defined what you want, and it's spelled out for your family so they can act on your behalf.
Lisa Schattinger?
That is just fantastic. I cannot tell you how true and how completely I agree with all of that. Again, we think that palliative care and hospice care when it's appropriate is so valuable, and if we start having all of these conversations earlier and start, talking to our loved ones about our thoughts. And again, if we're not fully informed of the path of our diseases and we don't know what questions to ask about them, then it's harder to make these decisions, and they are more, they come up as an emergency situation rather than something that we've planned for. Medical aid in dying is used extremely rarely. And they find that in the states that have it, those palliative care, the pain management, the hospice care has all really developed so strongly. And they really think that this whole conversation is happening earlier and people's end-of-life wishes are really being respected. So bravo. I agree completely.
Thanks a lot for that call, Frank. Appreciate that. I want to turn to Don now in Cincinnati. Don, you're on the air.
Yep. I had a friend that died here recently, and I don't feel the palliative care was very good. She had bone cancer, and I understand it's one of the worst kinds. But the fact that she laid there and quietly moaned and groaned and things like that is different from the way a person is when they go to bed and they groan and they roll over and they get more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that her moaning and groaning was simply muffled screams by the medication she was being given. But the medication actually was not helping her. It was just helping the people around her deal with her dying so they wouldn't have to hear her scream. I think that she was in extreme pain most of the time, and that American medicine is nothing as far as palliative care goes, at least in her case. That Canada has nationwide a physician-assisted suicide, that America is worth nothing. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. Thank you, Don. I'm sorry for the loss of your friend. Lisa Schattinger, that's the same kind of cancer that your stepdad had, right?
Yep, that's true.
It's tough.
Yeah, absolutely. And we want good pain management. We want good hospice care. And there are times when those symptoms can't be palliated. This is why we're having this conversation, is because some people come to the conclusion that this would be an option that would, in fact, give them comfort, whether they chose it or not. And, in fact, about a third of the people who receive the prescription do not use it, whether they just choose not to use it, they find that they don't need it, or, you know, they become incapable of using it. Yeah, we want people to have good care at the end of their lives. And you know, maybe that person did, but unfortunately, it can be tough to manage all those symptoms.
Don, thanks for that call. Turning now to Carol in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I've worked in medicine for 40 years in big institutions and small town hospitals. I've also had a mother with Alzheimer's that died of Alzheimer's, and a husband that died of esophageal cancer in hospice and was terminal for 3 years. So I've been definitely on both sides as a caregiver, a professional caregiver, and as family. The point that a lot of the Right to Life and the Republicans make about, well, we have such good pain meds now, that, sure, we have great pain meds now, but for one thing, our laws are getting a lot more difficult, and if you're in a hospice facility, that's not usually a problem. My husband wanted to die at home. This was in 2013, and I was running into problems getting the morphine filled, the morphine prescriptions.
Didn't hospice and just take care of that for you?
When he was in, when we finally went to hospice.
Oh, okay.
He was terminal. He knew he was terminal, but he wasn't with hospice yet, and he was having a lot of pain.
Okay.
I because I worked in a large teaching hospital, I was talking to one of the pharmacists one day, actually in the cafeteria, and she said, "From now on, just bring the script here, and I'll make sure you get what the doctor prescribed." But just taking it to, you know, to a CVS or whatever, I was having a lot of trouble getting it. They would give me enough for a few days.
Yeah.
And I was the primary caregiver. It wasn't always easy to get out to the pharmacy and pick it up.
Right.
And you have to have a handwritten prescription. You can't, you know, they can't fax that to the pharmacy. So it became a problem.
Yeah.
But not only that, but there are some kinds of pain that pain meds just do not help.
Right.
And
yeah, that's what Don was saying in Cincinnati earlier. Carol, we have to cut you short. I apologize for that. Thank you so much for calling in. I also want to thank Lisa Vigil Schattinger, Executive Director and Co-Founder of Ohio End of Life Options. Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me and for helping continue this conversation.
We'll continue our conversation with John Kelly. He's regional director of Not Dead Yet. That's a grassroots disability rights group that opposes legalization of assisted suicide. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. State Senator Charlita Tavares of Columbus last week introduced a bill that would legalize physician-assisted suicide in Ohio. It's unlikely the bill is going to get more than one hearing in the Republican-controlled Ohio General Assembly. But we want to talk about it. It's a significant issue. It's already legalized in a handful of states. We just heard from a proponent of physician-assisted suicide. Joining us now is Regional Director of Not Dead Yet, a grassroots disability rights group that opposes legalization of assisted suicide, John B. Kelly. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Why the fear that people who are disabled will be unfairly or improperly impacted by these kinds of laws?
Because these laws basically turn on the fact of people's disabilities. If you look at the report out in Oregon, the leading five reasons all have to do with disability.
Such as
Feeling like a burden, that's 50%. Loss of control of bodily functions, such as incontinence. Loss of autonomy, as in needing other people to assist you. Distress over dependence on others. Bodily shame, when people talk about death with dignity, they are implicitly opposing it to life within dignity. I am a disabled person. I depend on others for my daily care. I have incontinence, and I have loss of abilities, and yet I value my life very much. And we believe that everyone should receive equal suicide prevention services rather than some people who are disabled either by their serious illness or by disability, are given a go-ahead to die rather than to treat the conditions going on. In a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine, it concluded that the primary reason that people seek assisted suicide is because of existential distress.
What does that even mean?
It means that we're talking psychological factors.
Okay.
We're talking about people who feel that they are no longer respected by others, that they are a burden on others. They may want to pass inheritance on. I mean, you have callers calling in talking about the impact on family. The pretense of this bill is that individuals make choices all by themselves and that other people respect it. And come on, we all make decisions in a context. Feeling like a burden is one of the worst experiences any human can have, and that's why we support in-home funded care for everyone so that families are not put in the position of being burdened. And, you know, then just back to, you know, the bill says it's about options, but millions of people are misdiagnosed every year. Thousands of people graduate from their six-month hospice benefit every year. And there are many people who have been diagnosed as terminal who are still alive.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Jeanette Hull wrote to the Boston Globe in 2011 that she voted for the bill in Oregon. When she was diagnosed as terminal, she went to her doctor and asked for the drugs because she didn't want to suffer. She had heard all the news about it. He persuaded her to try more treatment, and as she wrote to the Globe, she was so glad she did, because she was alive then and she continues to be alive now.
Well, what about people who are in pain? Don from Cincinnati described his friend who was constantly moaning, constantly in pain from bone cancer. So setting aside the question of whether they're a burden, what if it's too painful?
Well, what we need then is good palliative care. And pain can be controlled. And it's outrageous that some people continue to suffer. But the answer is good palliative care, good emotional support, home care so people can stay in their homes. And as I said, pain is the trailing indicator for people out in Oregon because these people are in hospice. And to the extent that people are not getting their pain controlled, that's a medical failure. That is an outrage. We should all make sure that people have the pain relief they need.
Many terminally ill patients who want to die refuse treatment or stop drinking and eating. Is that something that you are concerned about, that you have a position on?
We don't have a position on people committing suicide. Personally, I think that people should be given better support and make sure that they have the supports they need and the counseling they need so that they can, live out their lives.
What do you ask for when you're asking lawmakers for more support? How is that manifest in state houses across the country? What aren't they doing now that you would be asking for?
Well, palliative care should be required for all doctors practicing in a state. They should be competent in it. There should be more palliative care, better palliative care. You know, hospice, you might only see a hospice worker for 1 hour a day. That's not enough. We have a lot of cost-cutting concerns going on, and that impacts assisted suicide also, in that people think that they may have a choice, but it's insurance companies who often decide who gets treatment and who doesn't. We're already seeing cases in Oregon and California where people are being denied treatment and being offered assisted suicide instead.
Are you advocating for any particular legislation that would bring about these reforms that you're talking about regarding palliative care?
We have worked with the state legislature to improve it, but this is something that medical societies should be getting behind rather than getting into, abandoning patients to suicide, especially when, doctors can't know exactly when someone is going to die. The error rate is huge. When there's no real way to tell whether people are depressed. I have many friends who are members of a group in Massachusetts called Empower, people who have experienced mental health issues. And, if you go in and you say, I feel like a burden, my life is worthless, rather than getting attention to your symptoms, people will say, well, of course, we understand because you're so ill. And we think people need to be treated for depression rather than depression being treated as a rational response to a serious illness or disability. And, we have to look at the larger culture here, the constant messages that life with a severe disability is not worth living, like the movie Me Before You last year, which concocted a rich billionaire guy who had a perfect girlfriend and had to kill himself anyway because he didn't want to subject his girlfriend to going to hospital appointments and such. And we have to look at abuse. Elder abuse and abuse of people with disabilities are epidemic. You know, it's estimated that 1 in 10 older adults are abused every year, 90% by adult children and caregivers. Nothing in these laws can stop an heir or abusive caregiver from steering someone towards assisted suicide, witnessing the request, picking up the lethal dose, and even administering the drug. No witnesses are required at the death. So okay. Who would know?
Let's take a call now from Sally in Dublin. You're on the air. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for taking my call. I do disagree with the gentleman that's on now. I think that's fine if he wants to fight for that. And I'm not talking about disability. I'm talking about what if you're 90 years old and you have cancer, and I have sat with family members in this situation and watched them die. And we don't do that to our pets. So I just disagree, and I'm for it, and actually to the point where I'll probably move to a state where they have it, just because I would like that peace of mind for myself. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Sally. John Kelly?
You know, the comparison of humans to pets is very instructive here, because pets have no choice. We determine that they are suffering, and then we go and kill them. And a lot of that's what's going on here. People look at other people, they say they are suffering, and they agree with the person in their distress that they would be better off dead. And, you know, in these bills, they talk about safeguards, but they're hollow. You know, there's no oversight, no witness at the death, and the state is denied any authority to enforce or investigate. There have been plenty of abuses out in Oregon, even though proponents continue to maintain there haven't been. For example, one woman, Wendy Melcher, was killed by two nurses, one of whom was having an affair with her own partner, and they killed her with a bunch of suppositories. And then rather than being referred to authorities for prosecution, were secretly dealt with by the state nursing board and placed on probation.
Well, I don't get what the connection with physician-assisted suicide. What does that have to do with that?
Well, because here were two people who killed another person but then said that it was assisted suicide. Wendy did have a disease. She was disabled and sick, but there was no doctor's prescription.
So they broke the law. They didn't follow
the law.
They broke
the law, but the law was not enforced because it was under the rubric of assisted suicide, and the state nursing board, rather than referring for prosecution, just said, one nurse lost license for 6 months and another was on probation. So what these laws do is they take away the ability of an investigation. And everyone involved is given a good faith exemption. So all you have to do, if you're the greedy heir of someone who just died, is say, oh, they wanted it, I acted in good faith. And a doctor who may have misdiagnosed plenty of people can say they acted in good faith. There's no tracking of misdiagnosis rates. And if this was a serious medical treatment, where are the journals? Where are the conferences on improving diagnosis?
John Kelly, we've got to leave it at that. We've run out of time, but I do appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's John Kelly. He is regional director of an organization called Not Dead Yet. It's a grassroots disability rights group that opposes legalization of assisted suicide, which is what we've been talking about today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for participating. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.